Uh-oh, here comes request for out of schedule. Out of, okay, good.
Oh, we're talking to the hand, I think. We're talking to the hand, I think.
Hi. No, no, no.
We'll do you first.
Hi. Hey,
I like to up a real time on
No, I didn't know it was going to get that much attention.
And what their current policy is.
Yeah, I didn't watch the
point is, I'll take part to blame because I didn't discuss it in context.
You shouldn't take blame for that. There was nothing alarming about it as it was written.
Okay. We'll talk to you about it. Mr. Myers, you're holding up the committee.
I have the sergeant at arms removed.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. We're going to open the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. It's Thursday, April the 28th. Good morning. And because we have a senator in our midst, we're going to start at the end on opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 530. We're going to open the meeting, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 530.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 530 changes the name of the Commission on Asian Affairs to the Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, and it clarifies some duties of the Commission. There's no revenue impact, there's a minimal fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you, Jen. Good morning, Senator. Would you please identify yourself? As a reminder, we all forget, and give us your concise, professional testimony.
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey. I think after yesterday, everybody knows who I am. But for the record, I'm Brian Boquist. I'm in District 12. Having said that, I serve on the parallel committee in the Senate, which is, of course, why I'm here. This is a good bill brought forth by the commission. The discussion that we actually had in our committee revolved around the Trade Opportunities Clause, which you see as the -1 amendment before you. If you'll recall, here in the state of Oregon, we have mandated that we're going to have foreign languages in our schools so that we'll be prepared for the global economy. In the foreign language classes that we have, we, of course, teach culture because you have to be able to understand the foreign culture and you need to understand the language if you're dealing in trade. The commission, and in our testimony, identified that they weren't quite sure why the word trade opportunities had been removed from the compiling list. It is inserted again on the second page at the top, and it says in the law as draft bill is written that came across the Senate, identify barriers to the economic development and trade opportunities of the Asian and Pacific Islander Americans within the state and advise state agencies officials on issues of these barriers. Well, if you're going to identify them, you still have to compile them. And I do want to say this is one of nine functions of the commission. It's not the primary function, probably not the bottom function of it. And when it comes to defining, compiling legally, that is put together from existing materials. The only concern that was raised in our committee about the bill, and we wanted to move it out and get it over to you folks so it could move along, is that there are times when commission members come across trade opportunities, as identified in their own bill language, and that information either needs to be passed on to Oregon Business, and likewise, Oregon Business being the state agency, and likewise the reverse. There needs to be the capability to go to these experts, because that's what they are. We've developed a commission to assist in Asian and Pacific Island issues, and they're the experts. They're the cultural experts. They're the social experts for dealing with those types of those countries, and in our mind, we thought, okay, maybe we should insert trade opportunities back in. We did not hold the bill up on the far side for any reason, and we said we'd propose an amendment and come back across to here, and it's really up to your committee to determine whether you want to move it out as is or you want to put in the -1 amendment that we proposed coming out of our committee. It's, again, a good bill. Nothing wrong with the bill itself. It's just a matter of having clarity that they're still going to identify and compile the nine functions.
Thank you very much, Senator. Committee members, any questions for the Senator?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Chair Hovey.
Thank you for coming over and giving us a heads up on trade opportunities. any idea why they took it out? Maybe you spoke to that a little bit, but why did they take that out originally?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, It's a little blurry after the fact, but having said that, during testimony, they didn't know. They just thought it was a Scribner, because if you look at the bill itself on lines, page 2, lines 13, 14, 15, and 16, trade opportunities is in there, and it was taken out, and then it was inserted up in lines 6, 7, 8, and 9. So on the surface, it looks like LC did its typical thing of saying, well, I got to have something more to do, so I'm just going to kind of move it around. But 6, 7, 8, 9 deal with identifying, and then the second paragraph, it deals with compiling. And so the explanation we got in committee from them was that they didn't know why, and they thought it was LC, it just kind of moved it around. And because we didn't exactly know why, and they weren't opposed to it, and we said, okay, we'll move the bill along and come to the House, we did the dash one amendment. Now, they may be able to give you a different, more intense, or more elaborate explanation now that they've gone back and regrouped. But again, it's a good bill. There's nothing even wrong with it as is. We just said, okay, if we're going to spend the money to do this, and they're the experts, and we're all dead in 10 years or gone, it's the word of the law that carries. I know the commission right now will say, hey, we'll do trade opportunities. That's not a problem. But when we're all gone 10 years from now, and somebody else is heading the commission, and we're no longer legislators, it's the word of the law that carries the day.
Thank you. Other questions, committee members? Senator, I'm sure that there's a correct or official definition of Pacific Islander, but do we need the bill? Did you discuss that, whether that definition or what you need to describe which countries or nations or...
Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative, or Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Pacific Islander includes, you know, Samoa, Guam, so on and so forth. We just briefly discussed that. I don't know that there's an all-encompassing definition, but I'm sure the commission can provide you with that.
Any other questions, committee members? Okay, Senator, because I think we won't accept, I think I would recommend that we move your amendment. We'll do that as soon as all the committee members get here. But because we have the amendment, then we have to wait.
Right.
So we could not move the bill today. But thank you for bringing forth this and your service on that committee.
And thank you, Co-Chair. And again, it's a good bill. I mean, it needs to be passed and come out. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-Chair.
We'll plan to move the dash one, and then as soon as we get the paperwork back from LFO.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Clem, yes.
We have the dash one somewhere?
Yes, it should be in your packet.
No, I don't have. Do I have it in my
right.
Brian, Representative Clem, it's just, as Senator Boquist said, it puts back in trade opportunities in line 15 that the LC must have mistakenly taken out.
Do you want to speak about that when we consider it in a work session?
Yes, sir.
That's a long-standing debate with this commission, is whether it's trade-focused or advocacy-focused. I don't think it's just an LC issue. My wife's been on it for 8 years. I can speak in great detail about that point.
Okay, we have one other person to testify. Patrick Singh, would you please? We can maybe bring it up here, Representative Clinton.
Yes, sure. And we're in public hearing.
We're still in public hearing.
I think that's an LC thing. It's a talk to us.
Good morning, sir. Identify yourself.
Good morning. Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey. My name is Patrick Singh. I'm the Vice Chair for the Commission on Asian Affairs. I've been serving in that position, or on the Commission, for this is my third year. First wanted to provide an official welcome to Representative Wisnett to the Commission as the newest appointee by the Speaker. We look forward to working with you. Sarah Boquist, pretty well in terms of the bill itself. Senate Bill 530 changes the name of the commission, which might seem like a very simple bill on paper, but has very significant meaning to Asians and Pacific Americans throughout Oregon. Over the past, a little background about Asian and Pacific Americans, we are the second fastest growing racial and ethnic community and projected to number over 200,000 in Oregon according to the 2010 census. And much of Oregon's population growth and diversity has occurred in the last two decades. Part of that is part of my own personal history. My dad is a Cambodian refugee, was part of the era of the Khmer Rouge post-Vietnam War. He had six brothers and sisters, five of which were killed during that time, including his parents. My dad was in the Cambodian military that was aligned with the U.S. troops, and he doesn't talk much about that experience, but one night he said, U.S. troops came into his camp and said, if you want to live, you will come with us, otherwise you will be... you'll just need to stay here and fend for yourself. So he came to the United States with a group of soldiers on a Pan Am cargo plane with no money. They were ready to join the U.S. Army if needed. Language barriers prevented them from doing that, but he created life, and I'm very thankful to him for me being here. So I'm part of a... fairly significant group of descendants of those Cambodian refugees. During commission hearings in the last many years, we've discussed how we can advocate better for Asian and Pacific Americans, especially in the last 2 years. Our commission has stepped up in public hearings that we've held in order to connect folks in our community, Asian Pacific Americans, to state agency and the work that state agencies are doing in specific to how they service Asian and Pacific Americans. And what we found out in talking to departments like DMV and education, and there's a large disconnect, most evident in our last public hearing with the Department of Education, where many folks see Asians as kind of a model minority when it comes to education. When you look at them on paper, you'll see sometimes they test better, have better graduation rates, but we have a very significant population of Pacific Islanders and some folks in the Vietnamese community and other Southeast Asian communities that are not doing well at all in school. And we need to, as a commission and as a state, look at some of those issues that are causing whatever barriers there are. So the name change kind of reflects our commission's goal to try to bridge some of those gaps. History on the commission. Commission was created in 1995, and it was charged with working for economic, social, political, and legal equality. Trade opportunities was included in that. I think where the trade opportunity, as Representative Clements said, we've had many discussions about this and what is our role as a commission. In 1999, the commission was kind of realigned with the other three advocacy commissions that exist in the state: Commission on Women, Commission on Hispanic Affairs, Commission on Black Affairs. And that was to do what I just said, promote economic, social, political, legal well-being. That doesn't necessarily exclude trade opportunities, but we would admit as a commission that although some commissioners may have a very strong interest or background in trade, we as a commission are not the experts and maybe have not been a part of a lot of the work and discussion on how we can expand our trade opportunities with our partners across the Pacific Ocean. We have seen a lot of that work has been taken by some legislators, like Representative Clem, who have taken their time to go to China and establish those relationships. Also, the Business Development Department and their International Trade Division have become real experts. So we are, as a commission, we have continued to talk about what our role is. We're not opposed to the amendment. In fact, I think with some of the new commission members that are joining here in the next few months, Stephen Ying, who is a Chinese business leader in the state, I think would be great in this particular area, and perhaps it is something that we need to reopen and discuss. So Commission is obviously very supportive of Senate Bill 530. We don't oppose the amendment and putting that trade opportunities back. Maybe it's a direction for us to continue that conversation and realign our efforts with state agencies and legislators who are working on this issue. Hope that you will also support Senate Bill 530 and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Patrick, for your excellent testimony, your background, and also your personal story, and for your discussion of the Dash 1. So, committee members, question? Representative Klim.
So I was looking at this upper section a little closer in under section 3, and it does remove trade opportunities from the compile information portion, but it actually adds it where it wasn't before in the barriers to economic development and trade opportunities. And so that's where I'm wondering if this was trying to find out from my wife, but she's not answering me as usual. I wonder if that wasn't intentional, meaning with the limited staffing available, one staff person for four different commissions, that using the commission public meeting process to bring forward and hear from people about barriers to trade opportunities for Asians and APIs, you know, might be appropriate, but compiling information is something already clearly done at Business Oregon, and they actually don't like people intruding into their turf, I've noticed, of trade. Unless it's ag products, then ag has it. And I'm not sure that's not intentional in terms of the compiling information part, that there's just not the resources to do that in two different agencies because it's already being done in one place. And I'm wondering if you recall a conversation about why it got added up above and deleted down below, or it truly was just intentional, or unintentional, excuse me.
Sure, Co-Chairs, Representative Klim. I can personally say I wasn't at the commission meeting where we discussed the amendment or some of the background, but some of the written communication that I've had with Carol Suzuki, your wife.
I'll be mailing my wife.
What? It states in Section 4 of the bill, kind of states the legislative mission or mandate for the commission, and I'll read it. It states, the Legislative Assembly declares that the Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs shall work for the implementation and establishment of economic, social, legal, and political equality for Asian and Pacific Islander Americans in this state, and to maintain a continuing assessment of the issues and needs confronting Asian and Pacific Islander Americans in this state. And Carol says she thinks this is the primary reason why those words were deleted. It did not seem congruent with the other areas for which we compile information and disseminate to our communities that impact a person's quality of life. During 2002 to 2005, as you're very familiar with, the commission didn't have a staff, so I think the commission is probably housed in your house.
Correct.
Carol was doing a lot of the work. She stated that she did receive some correspondence on trade and economic development, but then she would just refer them to then the Economic Development Department and the International Trade Division. So, again, we state that we've been lucky to have a commissioner, too, that has been an expert or has been involved in some of these issues. We still wonder about where our role is, as you state. There's a team of professionals that handles this, and maybe we can kind of coordinate if they'll let us.
Okay. Senator Boakes is still in the audience. Would you mind rejoining, re-identify yourself? And I think that, Senator, in your testimony, I think you said you were either way with Dash 1. And is that, would you confirm that, please?
Again, Senator Brian Boakes, Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey. Whatever the committee wants to do is fine with me, but I think I need to clarify, co-chairs, that let's look at the unemployment rate as 10%. So if Business Oregon is doing such a fabulous job, we have a U6 rate of 20% unemployment, a local rate of 10% unemployment, basically. And I'm not as enamored by Business Oregon in that terms of the opportunities out there. And so I think there is, value in having individuals who are from a specific culture, regardless of the commission, involved in it. But again, I'm not wedded to it. It does, by their own admission, they put trade opportunities up above. I'm not quite sure why exactly they did that and took it out of the bottom. I mean, I read the legal definition of compiling, which is from known sources, and I mean, our envisionment and the discussion in our committee co-chairs was that, okay, if the commission came across an opportunity, then yeah, they should email it over to Oregon Business, and 10 years from now, when it's not in Representative Clem's basement or house, wherever the commission's organized, that person just knows, yeah, I should make the connection and send it over to them. I think the whole Oregon Business is another discussion we'll also need to look at in jobs creation. But I'm amenable, whatever the committee wants to do. I think we put it on the record quite well that, you know, if a trade opportunity comes up, and I'm sure Patrick would point out that, you know, the economic well-being of, you know, Pacific Islanders, if there's a trade opportunity, they want to jump on it because they need a job like the rest of us do.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Chair Hobie had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm listening to this conversation a little bit and reading the bill, and I really see no advantage to leaving trade opportunities out. It seems to me that just having the commission identify trade opportunities with Asian and Pacific Islanders that are within this state, and if they identify some of those barriers that they can pilot and work with the other agencies, whether it's Business Oregon. Frankly, if they don't appreciate that input, I find that hard to believe. They should appreciate that input, and we should take advantage of the knowledge that that Asian and Pacific Islanders that are within this state have. And if they are aware of any barriers to trade opportunities, We would hope that they would bring that to our attention. So I'd be in favor of the -1 amendment and leaving that in for that specific reason. It doesn't say how big the information or compiling the information has to be. Maybe it's one item, maybe it's nothing. Certainly I think, as the Senator pointed out, if they come across any of the barriers, I think it should be identified and compiled and given to the appropriate agencies and the governor's office. I think more communication is better. So
Smith first. Representative Smith, you had a question?
I can wait.
Defer to Representative Clem.
So I don't have a massive problem with it. It's more about Business Oregon wanting control of our trade opportunities in some ways. But I will say this. I think there's a built-in assumption that because somebody's Asian, they're somehow connected to their home country here. I mean, it doesn't say have the Black Commission go back and talk to wherever their ancestry once came from. My wife's never even been to any of Asia except Japan, and that's like twice when she's three. She's not a trade master. She happens to have a family member who came from Japan 100 years ago. But that's it. And so if we think that every Asian's got, you know, some trade deals on the back burner, that's just not the way it is. Some of them are like, you know, refugees from Vietnam who don't, you know, they'll get killed if they even go back there, let alone do any trading. And they're not in the other commission statute. That's the absurdity of it. I'm not blaming anybody. Nobody knows that. But that's when, as soon as I hear, hey, let's make the Asians go trade, it just seems bizarre to me when it's not in the other commission statutes, as if somehow they're better at it than the Hispanics or something like that. I know this probably sounds absurd, but that's why I've always thought it was a little odd that they had this in there and nobody else did.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure the approach the bill sponsors would be, but that if there's haste to move the bill, I'd be comfortable moving the bill without the amendment. I guess I got questions about what the commission...
We can't move it today, but it's got to go...
What the commission members would say, you know, if not pressed, yeah, right, what their true preference would be about the language thing. I got no particular axe to grind, but I do have that question. Given
yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for that. Any other questions, committee members? Well, I think it's been really good discussion. Senator, you had a comment?
Just one brief comment. I would agree with Representative Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Holvey, Representative, I agree with Representative Clem to the point that it is an oddity that it's in this particular commission, but it ought to be in all the commissions. I mean, in this day and age of a global economy, no matter what commission, if they see an opportunity, they ought to be able to just, you know, jot a two-line email and send it to Business Oregon if Business Oregon is broad scoping and not stovepiped, as some of the testimony kind of indicated, which is why we're having an economic problem.
I haven't checked. I haven't checked this with Co-Chair Hovey, but if we're going to have an A, it should be in D. If you're not going to have it in D, I'm not sure you need it. If you're going to identify it and just identify it, what does that mean if you don't at least record it or pass it on to some other agency? It's been good testimony. Thank you very much. And so it looks like we're going to spend some more time addressing whether we put dash one in or not. And we'll try to do that and move it on quickly because we do want to expand the title of the commission. So thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
They want to be close to you. Oh,
I think I'll move.
What? Okay, committee, good discussion. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 530. We'll go back to the beginning of our schedule and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 151. Jen, summary, please.
Mr. Chairs and committee members, the bill expands and clarifies the Housing and Community Services Department's authority regarding use of monies in the Housing Development and Guarantee account, and it authorizes the department to set an interest rate on loans made from the account. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Krager, you want to come up? Good morning, sir. Glad to see you before the committee again. Would you please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony?
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnick, Co-Chair Holy. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Acting Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Nice to see you all again. I'm here today to present Senate Bill 151, which is Oregon Housing Community Services Bill. And as Jan alluded to, this is somewhat of just a technical housekeeping bill, but I'll try to provide you a quick overview of what we're trying to do with Senate Bill 151. First, as most of you know, I mean, one of the major things that we do as an organization is to help to finance the construction and rehabilitation of housing for low and very low-income Oregonians. And one of the key tools that we use as a department is what is called the Housing Development and Guarantee Account. Many people know this as the Housing Trust Fund. That's the term that it gets. A little bit of background about the Housing Development Guarantee Account. This was a fund created back in the early 90s, of which there are essentially two components to it. The legislature at that time deposited $15.5 million. That would go for a guarantee pool for us to provide loan guarantees. And then the second part to that was that the interest earnings on that particular corpus would go to the second half of the fund, which would ultimately provide loans and grants for the purposes of developing affordable housing. In addition, during that time, the legislature appropriated general fund for the purpose of doing those grants as well. So you had both the source of general fund as well as interest earnings from the corpus to make these grants. Now, over the years, that source has changed a lot. It was once general fund, it was lottery, and then general fund went away. And today, it's public purpose charge that is deposited directly into that account for the purposes of providing grants and loans. So that's a little bit of background of the fund that we're talking. What we're asking for in this bill is really kind of three things, and I provided you a little bit of detail line by line, but in summary, there are really three pieces that we're trying to accomplish here. Number one, as I mentioned, we are allowed to provide loans. However, most of the work that we have been doing over the years has been with grants. And the reason is because by law, we are required to establish the interest rate on these loans on the basis of a U.S. Treasury long-term obligation. And I'll be real honest with you, for us to do affordable housing at rates at 6 and 7% just doesn't work. So the attractiveness of a loan is just not there. So primarily we use the fund in the form of grants. What we'd like to be able to do is have the ability to establish our own interest rates just like we are with all of our other loan products in the department, and at some point be able to revolve some of those principal loans back to the department. So we think that by removing the piece that establishes the loan rates via the U.S. Treasury Index and then allowing the department to establish the appropriate loan rates would be the best way to go with this particular fund. And again, I remind the committee that's how we do most of our other loan products as well. The second piece to this, as mentioned on page 2 of my testimony, is as it relates to the investment earnings on this particular account. If you look in law, and if you read it completely, it would say that the only thing that we could spend out of the Housing Development Guarantee account would be the investment earnings from the corpus. But as we all know, general fund appropriation and other dollars have been appropriated by the legislature for the purpose of the grants. So our Department of Justice has interpreted the intent of the legislature was to use all monies appropriated to the account for grants or loans. But again, if you look at the law, it looks like the only thing that you can actually spend is the investment earnings off the corpus. So from the advice of the Department of Justice, we're trying to clarify in law so that it lines up with legislative intent that we're allowed to not only spend the investment earnings, but we're also allowed to spend any money appropriated by the state legislature. And then the final piece to this, co-chairs Holvey and Wisnett is, and members of the committee, is just primarily some grammatical change and some structural change, some things recommended by legislative council to clean it up. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might
have. Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Committee members, questions? Chair Holvey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Welcome back, Mr. Krieger. I'm curious about the account, and just have a question about how much of the account is used in constructing new housing as opposed to acquiring and rehabilitating.
Co-Chair Holvey, in terms of, I'd have to get the specific number for you as it relates to this particular pool of dollars, but as in my previous testimony related to the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, what we were seeing was about 35% of the dollars were being used, or the credit was being used for construction. So my educated guess here, Representative Holvey, would be close to the same. But I will certainly follow up with you on that.
Yeah, I would like to know. Thank you.
I had that down as a question you were going to ask. Any other questions, committee members? Mr. Krieger, on the second page of the bill, line 1, can you explain to me, to pay for costs to develop nonprofit organizations? Can you explain that, please? We're paying the cost to develop nonprofit organizations.
Mr. Chairman, this particular piece was at one point there were dollars that were appropriated by the legislature for the purposes of capacity building for organizations, and some of the dollars could be used to help in the form of developing those organizations. Since that time, those general fund dollars have gone away, and we no longer do that. Primarily, what we do is provide it for the other purposes of financing the affordable housing. So this is an allowable use under the Housing Development Guarantee account, but I can tell you from our experience, we haven't been allocating that money towards that.
Okay, I would appreciate we talk about that further. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much for your testimony and bringing forth this. Hey, committee members, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 151. Open a public hearing on 157. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 157. Jan?
Committee chairs, committee members, this bill provides for one member of the Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying to be registered photogrammetrist. Reduces the number of board members that must be registered professional engineers. There are no amendments before you, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Mrs. Norton, since you did your research, you want to tell the committee members what I
a photogrammetrist. Seriously, they measure the distance between two points that lie on a plane parallel to the photographic image plane using, if the scale is known. So, using a photograph to measure distances.
Thank you very much. Dan, you want to come up and tell her if she did that right? Thank you.
Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Dan Lynch. I'm Yamhill County Surveyor out of McMinnville. I think she did a good job defining that. Remote sensing is a highly technical job, a profession that takes a lot of skill and experience and education to get really good at. And if you slip up, you don't know what you're doing, and you're out of your area of expertise and discipline, then you can get in trouble real quick. And our board, I've been on our board on OSBILS for 10 years.
Okay.
And we, let's see, that was 2005. This became law to have photogrammetrists licensed. And since then, we have gone through the grandfathering portion, and we've got the exams ready to go. Everything's going pretty smoothly, but there are times when we have questions at the board. We really, among the board members and even the lay people on the board, we don't have the expertise necessary to address questions relating to this particular profession. So we agreed as a board to bring this to this session and see if we could get that corrected by allowing this to happen, get a photogrammetrist on the board. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Committee members, Chair Hovey and I just think that we can move this unless you have any questions or issues with it. So please ask our expert here if you have any questions.
Chair Hovey. Just one for clarification. So under the way the statute's laid out right now, I'm assuming that the registered photogrammetrist does not fit into any of those other categories.
Co-Chair Hovey.
So you couldn't put one on the board now?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair, wasn't it? We could technically, if we had a PE or an LS that was doing that as a way of business, they could actually be registered as they could have grandfathered in, and some of them did. And in my written testimony, I addressed that a little bit. We haven't been able. I've tried and tried for years to get one of those folks to step up and be on our board. They're so busy being PEs as well as photogrammetrists, they don't have the time or inclination to do that. So this is a way out to allow the board to have that benefit the public, we think.
Thank you.
That's a good question. How many of the photogrammetrists are there in the state of Oregon?
There are only several dozen that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you. Okay, more the questions, committee members? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157. Committee members would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 157.
Mr. Chair, no amendments before us. I move Senate Bill 157 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Any discussion, committee members? Seeing no questions or discussions, Tamara, will you please call the roll?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye.
Chair Wizard.
Aye. Committee members, Co-Chair Hovey and I would like to put this on consent agenda. Is any objection to that?
Someone needs to try and pronounce that on the
board. Not me.
I was going to volunteer.
Okay, consent. We stumbled through photogrammetric mapping already.
Okay.
Photogrammetric.
With the vote, the motion passes, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 157. Committee members, will open a committee public hearing on Senate Bill 293. Jan, summarize, please, and we'll have the testimony.
This is a measure that modifies the statutory provisions regulating the negotiation of rental agreements and the disclosure of rent and fees. It modifies provisions related to retaliatory actions by landlords. It increases the threshold from $500 to $1,000 by which a landlord may choose to destroy or dispose of abandoned property. Clarifies the tenant's rights to apply security deposit or a prepaid rent toward the rent owed when the landlord's property is in foreclosure, and allows the landlord to require the tenant to restore security deposit or the prepaid rent within 2 months when property is no longer in foreclosure. releases immediate family from a rental agreement if a tenant is a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and it applies to rental agreements entered into on or after the effective date. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Miller. Mr. Van Lindenham, Ms. Isma, MC, and Jim Strupp. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Capitol. Please identify yourself before your testimony and present your concise testimony on a very big folder.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is John Van Lindenham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I'm here on behalf of the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition with two members of that coalition, Deborah Imsey from the Metro Multifamily Housing Landlord Group in Portland, and Jim Straub from Oregon Rental Housing Association, Jim's in Eugene.
Thank you.
Jim doesn't like the publicity, but I'd like to note that Jim is the grandson of former Governor Bob Straub. So the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition has been in existence since the early 1980s. It consists of landlord representatives and tenant representatives. It is the older sibling of the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, whose bill will also be before you someday. And this group tends to be less controversial than the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. So we've got about 50 people on our email list. I'm the electronic secretary and the chief explainer of the bill. As I said, we've done this since the early 1980s. We negotiate changes. In the 2009 session, we did some very complicated and controversial issues, and so this time we agreed among ourselves that we would do smaller and less controversial issues. Not to say that they're not important, but they're just not as controversial. The bill passed out of the Senate General Government Committee 5-0 unanimous, passed the Senate floor 27-2. There are eight issues in the bill. I've given you a handout that describes those issues in greater detail. I'd be glad to bore you to death with those details because that's what I do for a living, but I'm guessing you don't want to do that. So, Mr. Chair, I would defer to you as to how much detail, you, if any, you want.
Thank
about
you. We'll do the testimony and see how much the committee would like to get into this. Thank you.
Co-Chair Holfe, Co-Chair Lisnett and Committee, I'm Deborah Imsey, the Executive Director for Metro Multifamily Housing Association, and I'm just here this morning to lend my support to the bill and say that, it, as John mentioned, it was a far less controversial session this time, and that was a pleasure, so thank you.
My name is Jim Straub at the Oregon Rental Housing Association. We're headquartered here in Salem, and we have representatives or districts throughout Oregon and pretty much every county around the state. We represent right around 3,000 landlords and 70,000 rental units. Just wanted to note how wonderful it's been, actually, not to too many accolades to John, but when he say it's a negotiation, it's actually more of an intelligent discussion on the matter, and we as landlords appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony and all your work on this. We need more organizations like you working out these issues to bring us, I'm assuming they're not unanimous decisions, but majority decisions, and that's still, that's good for the people of Oregon. Committee members, any questions on these agreements that they've negotiated, the eight issues? Representative Sheehan, Vice Chair Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 34, it adds 30 or 60 days written notice for a month-to-month tenancy for termination. Why did that go to include 60, and can you speak to just the mechanism of having 30 or 60 in statute and which one it would be and why you would have two in there?
Co-Chair Wisner and Representative Sheehan, that change is reflects a change that we made in 2009. You made in 2009. We negotiated in 2009. It was one of the controversial changes that we agreed to negotiate at that time. And what we agreed to do was to say that when a landlord uses a no-cause termination notice, most tenancies are month-to-month tenancies. Most residential tenancies are month-to-month tenancies. And they can be terminated by either side on a 30-day no-cause notice. The change that we made in 2009 was to say that after, if the tenancy has lasted a year, after that, if a landlord wants to use a no-cause notice, the landlord has to give 60 days notice instead of 30. So, that's a big deal, both to tenants and to landlords, to give the longer notice. It was part of our hard-fought negotiations in 2009 and became law. And it is in a different statute that is the primary. It's 90.427. It's the primary statute on no-cause terminations. This statute that's before you that you asked about has to do with RV tenancies. And it is simply that statute simply cross-references 90.427 to say that I could clearly bore you further, but I'll let you decide how much you want to know. So it's RV tenancies, and we're cross-referencing the no-cause terminations in 90.427, which prior to 2009 could only be a 30-day notice. After 2009, it could be either 30 or 60. We failed to do that cross-reference in 2009, so we're cleaning that up. So it wasn't controversial this time. It was controversial last time.
Thank you.
Good.
Good. Good question. Other committee members? Wow, so that your work was well done. So.
Thank you.
Committee members, before I dismiss the panel, we're going to plan to move this unless you have other questions. Okay, thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157. Am I the right number?
293.
Guys, keep track here. We're moving so fast. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 293. Open a work session on Senate Bill 293.
Mr. Chair, now, being that we're not bored yet, I'd like to move Senate Bill 293 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hovey moves Senate Bill 293 and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Okay, any discussion, comments? Thank you. Okay, Representative Sheehan.
Vice Chair Sheehan. How did this come out of the Senate? What was the vote? Do you know?
Yes, they told 27-2.
Thank you.
5-0 out of committee and 27-2 out of the on the floor. Thank you. Okay, other questions, discussions? Tamara, would you please call roll?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flood.
Excused.
Representative Calder.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye.
Chair Wisdom.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you. I guess we better have a okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 293. We need to hear on that.
Sure.
Would you? Thank you, Representative Smith. Okay. So let's moving along. We're at 392. Committee members, will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 392. Jan, please summarize.
Yes, Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 392 continues to exempt the names and locations of persons engaged in animal research at the Oregon Health and Science University from disclosure as the public record until January 2nd, the year 2016. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Thank you very much, Jan. Do we have the sheet? I think, thank you. Okay, we'll bring up Mr. Fisher, Ms. Phillips, and Ms. Masadi, thank you. Apologize. Good morning. Welcome. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher. I'm with Northwest Public Affairs. I'm standing in today for my colleague, Phil Donovan, whose wife gave birth to twins on Friday.
I saw the email. Congrats.
And representing OHSU.
Twins, right?
That's correct, yes. The Oregon Legislature has played an important role in the continued success of efforts to keep researchers and staff who work at Oregon National Primate Research Center, or the ONPRC, safe. Today we're asking for your support of Senate Bill 392 that extends current law, namely the sunset on OHSU's redaction authority to January 2, 2016. The bill exempts from public disclosure the names and locations of individuals and vendors affiliated with OHSU's scientific community who perform cutting-edge medical research in neuroscience, pathology, immunology, and reproductive sciences. This research puts OHSU and Oregon in the forefront of medical research in the U.S. For example, in 2007, a research project at OHSU was recognized as Time Magazine's number one scientific breakthrough of the year. With me today is Dr. Ilhan Massoudi, who will talk about the importance of this legislation to the over 500 people who work at the Oregon National Primate Research Center and the entire OHSU community. Also on the stand today is Janet Billups, OHSU legal counsel, who will describe the protocols to ensure all record requests are treated equally and that all staff involved have an accurate understanding of the processes to be followed. And that concludes my
very much. We'll go ahead and have everyone testify, please, and then we'll ask questions.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holby. My name is Janet Billups. I'm in-house legal counsel at the Oregon Health and Science University. When this law was first passed in 2003, we were asked by the then Senate Judiciary Chair to create a process to ensure that the media was ensured access to information. We did that, so we had two separate processes. Things change, and in the last session, we were asked by the committee to review and revise that process so that all requesters are treated the same. We did that, and it was a useful exercise. What we first of all were able to verify is that with respect to the general public, people who make requests, we do not and have never treated people differently based on who they are. We did have a separate process for the media. We have now updated our process to ensure that all requesters, media, and the general public, that we follow the same process, and no one is treated any differently. Our public records coordinator and our media office have been trained along those lines. With this current law in place, requesters can receive detailed records of all the animal medical records. They get every piece of information down to the dose of medicine and everything else that an animal receives. What is withheld under this law is the specific link of a name to animal care, animal treatment, and animal research. We believe that this law provides interested people, the public, with complete access to all information regarding how animals are treated, and yet it provides an adequate safeguard to protect the safety of our researchers and other technical staff who work in support of animal research. We think this is an appropriate balance that strikes and recognizes both needs. My last comment relates to the National Association for Biomedical Research. That is a Washington, D.C.-based association that advocates for both funding and policy support for medical research. The NABR recently published its analysis of states that support medical research through researcher safety laws. And Oregon ranked fifth highest amongst all states due in large part to this law. We hope and request that this law be allowed to continue. That concludes my comments. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ilhan Massoudi. On behalf of the scientists at the Oregon National Primate Research Center and the OHSU community, first of all, I would like to thank you for hearing us today. This legislation is very important for me, for my family, as it is for my colleagues and their families at OHSU. I just want to give you a very brief background as to who I am. I am an assistant scientist at the Oregon National Primate Research Center. My research efforts focus on understanding why our immune system changes with age and how that impacts disease. As you all know, elderly individuals are more susceptible to infection, and my research focuses on understanding that, with the ultimate hope that we can devise some interventions to improve their immune system and make vaccines more efficacious in the elderly. Most of our research is funded by tax dollars, and as such, we have a responsibility to inform the public of our advances that we make on a daily basis to human well-being and human health and well-being. And we do this by publishing our research, attending national and international meetings, and talking to visitors that come to our primate center on a regular basis. We are not afraid of public scrutiny, and in fact, we welcome it and consider it part of rigorous research. Unfortunately, tactics employed by animal rights extremists, whom we define as individuals who use illegal and menacing means to incite violence against scientists, have changed. And the FBI has documented a trend that has moved away from targeting institutions such as OHSU at large to actually targeting individual scientists. Some of my colleagues have been harassed in their homes, have had their cars vandalized. Actually, just this past week, two of my colleagues have had people visit their homes with bullhorns and their families are still recovering from the weekend. However, even though we have these incidents, in the last 8 years that this law has been in place, we have not experienced the violence that California has. We do need precautions. People are not moving out of windows in their homes to escape a fire in their home. Animal extremism has to be combated in two ways, we believe. First of all, by protecting those of us who conduct medical research using animal models, but also through public discussion in a civilized and informative manner. We, the scientists at OHSU, believe that releasing detailed animal records but redacting our names will provide meaningful access to those records while ensuring protection for those of us who do scientific research. I thank you for your time. Please support the Senate bill. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony. Committee members, questions? No questions.
Oh, sorry. Chair Hope. No, I'm sorry. I'm not looking. I'm looking here, Chair.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my only question is, why is there a sunset date? Why not just make this thing permanent? It sounds like this is working and this is a good bill. Why have it sunset at all?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Vice Chair Sheehan. It has been historically the case with this bill that it has been done in certain lengths of time so that the legislature has an opportunity to monitor how it is going, and that's the direction that that the Senate side wished to pursue, and so we're pursuing that as well.
Other questions, committee members? Chair Hovey.
Thank you. I think it's absolutely critical we protect workers from the type of harassment you're discussing. It's sort of confusing to me, though, that if those names are being protected, how are they still being harassed recently with, you know, people visiting their homes? How are they getting that information now if that information is being protected?
Do you want to... Sure.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett. The law has been in place for a while, but not forever, and names and home addresses predated the establishment of the law. I think that is one reason why some home addresses are still made available. I don't have much more of an answer to your question than that. This law has helped. It has certainly helped, but it's not 100% guarantee. Did you?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. I guess that helps. So what you're saying is that people are being harassed as of recently, have been around so long that they predate the protection of information being disclosed.
I think that's part of the reason. The other is we haven't seen any menacing or intimidating, harassing activities towards the vast majority in terms of volume of employees and vendors who work in this field. The people who were harassed is almost too tame of a word, harassed in their homes this past week, along with their children, were very prominent PIs, principal investigators, who have recently gained national attention through ABC News and Nightline. And I wish that there were a perfect way to protect them 100% of the time, but there hasn't been in those two cases. We haven't seen any incidents, however, of lower level, less prominent employees being harassed, and I think in large part because of this law.
Follow up.
Thank you. And another question. So you've mentioned a couple of things that just sort of made me think about as I remember this bill from past, you know, and I do support protecting the individuals for sure, but I do sort of wonder about you know, exactly what the policy is on what information is being protected and not being disclosed. And I think you mentioned that the policy before had a different policy for media and as opposed to the general public, and now you have a policy that is the same for media and the public. And and to follow up, do you have a written policy on that that could be shared?
Yes, we do, Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby. We have a written policy, I think was introduced at the Senate side. We certainly more than happy to make it available to you. In terms of the policy, I would say it's more of a process than a policy change. The process with the media was that when a request came in from the media for certain information, before a denial would be made, it had to be reviewed and approved by three separate units within OHSU, and then kicked up to the executive of each of those units. One was the provost, one, I can't remember all three units, but very high level. Whereas, it was all managed by the media department. Whereas requests from the general public did not go through the more elaborate process. They were just processed in the normal manner, which was a public records coordinator would collect the records, review it, redact whatever was available. The process now is that there is not an elaborate internal review. A request comes in from the media. It's still managed by the media department, but there's no difference in treatment in terms of the end result or the internal review that's done. Does that help? Okay.
Yeah, and just one last question, I guess. So the purpose of this policy is basically, the sole purpose of this policy is to protect the names of the workers and their addresses and identifying who they are, essentially, to the public or to the media.
That is the exclusive purpose, excuse me, the only reason for this law.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Klim?
Can you tell me just a little bit more about some of these groups? I mean, do they have names, or who are these people? Don't they have anything better to do? Do they have jobs? What do we know about these people?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, Representative Klim, those are very good questions, and I share some of the questions you ask. You know, I'm not prepared to give you a lengthy description of who these groups are, but there are organizations who don't believe that.
Can we start to keep records of them? Can we just start
right.
publishing both of those on the internet?
Look them up on the Google.
That animal models should be used, and so that's what their concern is, and they have chosen tactics to try to prevent that, which
I understand their concern. Follow up,
please.
I understand their concern. It seems like you come down here and try and get a bill passed or something like that instead of following people around, and you know, it's just an interesting tactic to think that's going to be the most effective way to spend your time. It's, you know, it seems like there's a mushroom somewhere they could go protest saving or something else they could go do.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm curious how you guys avoided the Judiciary Committee this session
last time.
And I actually would, without merely joshing, suggest to the committee that we might consider referring it to the Judiciary Committee. Maybe this has something to do with economic government accountability. Maybe it has something to do with consumer protection. But I know that members of the Judiciary Committee reviewed this subject matter in the past and have some awareness and expertise in it. I do have a question. In past sessions, my rough understanding is that you had a log on how the Primate Center handled public record requests and that it provided that to the committee. Is that log still kept? Do we have it? Can we see it?
Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holby, the log that you're referring to, I believe, was a log that was created at the request of or as part of the last session. I don't know that we have an updated log that is maintained. I mean, we certainly could put together a log.
Follow up? Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, my understanding, my understanding was a little different. There certainly was a log. Mm-hmm. It might or might not have been updated with some consistency. But regardless whether we know that to be true or not, we now don't keep track of the log and we don't have it here?
We created the log for the committee's purposes at the last session. So since it was created for the committee, it wasn't an ongoing log that was that was maintained for internal record keeping purposes. We definitely have records of every record that comes in, and it can be easily created, formed into a log if you would like something like that. But yes, we have the records. We just don't have an ongoing log that was created for a singular purpose 2 years ago.
Thanks. Another question, Mr. Charlotte,
please.
Have we considered the sort of least intrusive set of protections, the least, the various options to address this? My wife works at OHSU, is a fan of the sign that has the little mouse and the person, and she and I agree on some things and disagree on some things. She is very passionate about duct tape on the Rose Festival parade route, for instance, and fluoride in the water. These are issues we talk about. But have we thought about other options to address this? Is this the sort of, to use a dorky term, the most narrowly tailored way to address the concerns you guys are after?
Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, as part of the process that Ms. Billups described, through the interim since the last session, we looked at a lot of other options to see if there were better alternatives. And we looked at examples of laws in Utah that are restricting public protests, and we didn't think that that was appropriate in Oregon. We looked at other laws that other states have passed, and in the end we came back to that this seems to provide the most protection while still giving the most access to public records, and it was at that point that we decided to pursue this sunset renewal. I'd be happy to give you further information on detailed information on some of the other options that were explored.
Thanks.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Smith's comment about sending this to the Judiciary. I happened to sit on Judiciary for two sessions, and this was a big issue. We spent a lot of time on it, so there is some knowledge on this committee of history of this issue from the members, and I want to just clarify what this bill is doing. Basically, is extending the sunset on existing policy that we already currently have, that was worked very, very hard and spent a lot of time in Judiciary in previous sessions, and also just hearing the testimony today, that it's still not preventing people from figuring out who people are in the past, and so this is a pretty moderate ask to extend an existing policy. So I'm very supportive of extending the sunset out today.
Representative Smith.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, and it is And I guess, you know, composition of the legislature changes, even if composition of the legislature doesn't change, composition of committee committees change. But, you know, part of it would seem to me the reason we do the sunset it is then to have, you know, is to check it out and see how it goes. And if we check it out, but then it goes to, I mean, I guess there are a couple of us who are on that committee, so certainly some overlap. But if it goes back to the same decision-making body that did the work in the first instance, and then get to say, so we had a sunset, how did it go, rather than merely be tutored by, you know, sort of a game of telephone and some overlap, seems not to be as ideal. I understand you guys don't make committee assignments, and if you did, I have some things I want to talk to you about where bills are going. But I agree with everything that Representative Cameron said, and still think it might be worth having just your way.
Thank you. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for all you do for health of, and all the money you make up there at OSHU. We need the revenue. Thank you. We have Mr. Bessler and Ms. Dalton. Mrs. Dalton.
Dayton.
Yes. Goodbye. Yes. Good morning. Please identify yourself. We all forget every time we testify, and give us your concise testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Holvey Wisner. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm general counsel with the Oregon Medical Association, and I apologize. My handwriting must have been worse than usual this morning. We are here in support of the bill. Oregon physicians rely on the research that's being done to care for their patients now and in the future. And the safety of those researchers paramount. Research is paramount. We see no reason why a researcher's personal information, their name, their home address, should be attached to the research they do. That threatens the safety of that researcher and of their family. And Oregon physicians simply cannot continue to do the good work that they do without this research. And we don't, we fear that releasing personal information about physicians will further incite researchers will further incite violence against them and their families. We see no reason for that, and we urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe?
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 392. We represent about 24,000 members across the state, and about 30 of those work at the Primate Center, but not a lot of folks, but they care very, very, very deeply about this issue. Our members are habitat technicians. They help feed and take care of the animals, and they want to make it very clear that they care deeply about the animals, and you know, they have a sort of a sense when they can look into the center and sort of tell which ones are hurting, which ones are having problems, and they work hard to make sure to maintain the health of those animals. This is a very deep issue for them. It's about their personal safety. These are real threats that happen, and they do feel very scared and harassed. This bill is a great bill, but it doesn't stop all the harassment. There are still lots of things they have to deal with on a regular basis, but this is an important step to protect them. The one thing I'll be concise. The one thing I will leave is one of our members who works in the mailroom isn't working in the Primate Center. She's seen some of the things that have come in through the OHSU mailroom directed at those folks, and there's some scary stuff. And she says the people who want this information don't want to discuss the merits of animal research. They want to scare and harass our folks. And so that's something we want to make sure to leave you with. Thank you very much.
Thanks for putting that on the record. Mrs. Dayton, for the record, too, would you repeat that this bill is only restricting personal or their residential, and I'm assuming that OSHU has a list of people doing this research, and it's available, you know, on an official list. So their name and where they work, and that is available.
Culture Hovney and Wisnet. Yes, I'm glad to reiterate that this bill restricts disclosure of personal information, name, address of people engaged in research. The particular records kept by OHSU, I would ask Ms. Phillips to respond to, but I would imagine they do have that information.
Thank you. Committee members, questions for this panel? I think everything got you guys get off easy. Thank you. And we have Mrs. Myers. Ms. Myers.
I'm now on a lobbying effort to become Meyer again.
Okay. Apologize.
That's okay. Good morning. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and we are here today in opposition to Senate Bill 392 and parts of it, and I want to explain why, and I appreciate that Representative Smith recognizes history. I was rather surprised to see this come to this committee as well. It's been around. It always does go to judiciary, and there is some uniformity with that and the continued conversation. Oregon has a very strong public records law, and I want to quote a portion of the Attorney General manual because I think it's insightful of why it's not just the media. It is, as the Attorney General manual states, interested persons, news media representatives, business people seeking access for personal gain, busybodies on fishing expeditions, persons seeking to embarrass government agencies, and scientific researchers of all standing on equal footing. So our public records are not media and everyone else, and you all deal with the public records yourselves. You are a public body of public officials. To be clear, we have not and we have never opposed the removal of the home address as it is in any way available in those documents. Indeed, we think that there is already statute available to do that. What we oppose is the unprecedented removal of a name of an individual on a public record. We believe this law has been misused. The argument is that by providing the name of the researcher tied to the research activities, it will spread misinformation, and as a result, those individuals out there who are intent on criminal activity will spread misinformation. But if only partial records are released, that is actually how you spread misinformation. And I want to quickly explain why the name on these documents is relevant to law-abiding watchdog organizations, whether it's the media or it's other nonprofit law-abiding organizations. There are many, many, I will just give you an example. There are many, many primates up at OHSU. Researchers are handling, any individual researcher might be working with only a certain number of primates, let's say 50. They actually submit and often get federal grants that have their names on it. Now, you know, the fact that they're doing this research, and I'll get to that more of that in a moment, is completely public. Their names are out there all the time. This is not a law that protects their safety, but for this, no one would know who is doing what. But what it does do is if there's a organization, and again, I want to reiterate there's law-abiding. You know, Representative Clem and others, you've talked about, and yes, we recognize there are individuals out there who are intent on engaging in criminal activity. But we cannot say that individuals who, whether they're interested in environment, they're interested in animals, they're interested in guns, they're interested in health issues, and they advocate for those, we cannot say that all of those people, because there are a few, are all criminals. And I'm here not speaking for the criminals. I'm here speaking for the law-abiding groups. But to see how particular animals are being handled, to ensure that the compliance with the federal grant of how they're going to handle them is done, you need to get that individual researcher's records on the protocols and how they are currently handling the animals. And that is the information they are removing. I want to then quickly speak to how we believe that OHSU, at the same time wants the names removed, continues to undermine the safety of their very own researchers. In this past, I have talked about, and over on the Senate side, I've talked about the fact, and I'll show you, I didn't attach it to the testimony, they post the photographs of these researchers. Every session I've talked about this. Here's just an example. I just linked all these together from last session. Here are photographs and descriptions and names of the research activities of these individuals. Now, on the Senate side, they said, well, researchers have the ability to choose whether or not they feel comfortable having their photograph on there. I would have thought OHSU would have always given, and would presume actually that OHSU has always given their researchers that right. Hopefully you will actually not find my photograph on the website.
I've got everyone searching. You'll find my photograph on the websites here. But I take steps to ensure my safety, and one of them is to not have my photograph, because if there's someone intent on going after me, having my picture is rather helpful. So I think when you're at a public agency that's asking you to pick and choose, you need to be careful and cautious in the argument of public safety, that what they're really doing is trying to remove information. And here's why. Because in the past, this law, without this law, it has been used to uncover activities that are rather unpopular. They're activities that have embarrassed the institution. Only by having the names of the researchers whose monkeys were self-mutilating was the public made aware of a serious animal abuse going on at OHSU that led to changes. This type of investigation is now nearly impossible without being able to link the names and the and the animals to see how they're being handled. Because of this law, we now would not have learned that in the 1990s, Clackamas County Animal Shelter was selling dogs to OHSUs to be used for research. Again, public knowledge and release of that information affected change. That cannot happen under this law. You will not know. I'm surprised, first of all, at a few things that were pointed out and discussed by the previous proponents. First of all, the log has been kept since the law was originally passed. It was not a log just provided to the legislature in 2009. I have one from 2003, 2005, 2008. It is an ongoing log. This is the first session that we've not seen it. I think the reasons why are that the log has exposed that actually OHSU, despite the testimony saying we look back and found nothing distinguishing how we treat people, I will quote from a previous log in which they noted about how they treated different groups, and they would put it, you know, PETA or whatever, and they said PETA. In additional details, they said, in the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care. I need to remind this committee that's not a crime. That's free speech. You all are subject to people spreading false information about you or what you think might be false information, but that's not a crime. Also, they talked about the previous policy, really just treating the media and everyone else differently. Again, I want to read from the policy, and I have attached it to my testimony. I do not see a new policy, but I think it's more informative of how for 6 or 7 years they had an old policy. They had, as it was discussed by the proponents, specific language about how to handle the media requests. But the language regarding the public was not the general public. The language was what to do when an animal rights organization seeks information. Again, not when they think a person suspected of crime seeks it. And I quote, the coordinator will also collect as much information as is available on the requester. Is it an animal rights activist or an animal rights organization? Does the requester have a history of opposing medical research involving animals? Information sources including websites, public safety, and knowledgeable OHSU administrators. In other words, OHSU is going to investigate the people asking. And if they are an animal rights organization, which is not against the law to be in our country, they are going to handle it differently. And we believe, the record has shown, redact the information from those documents where they do not need to do so for the press. We urge you respectfully not to continue with this law. We think that while the motivations are sincere from the researchers, the law has been used to shut down law-abiding organizations' ability to track and document and take to the public, whether it's the media or through other ways, to educate the community on how animals are being used and in some cases exposing misuse. This is a public agency. If they don't want to have this information available, do not take and become a public agency. But their names, their photographs, and the types of research that they are doing is all over the web. So removing them from how they treat particular animals at any given time so that people wanting to do a watchdog to track down to see if they're holding them true to their word is not the way to go. I'm happy to answer any questions and appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions? Representative Klim.
I'm still trying to grasp one of the arguments you made about the patterns between individuals and, like, okay, actually, let's do the Clackamas County thing. What is it in that investigation, and I'm not disputing there's a difference between people who want to go and harass people at their homes and people who don't like things, but what is it that required a name to find out about the sale of OHSU animals versus some whistleblower told them, and it's that two organizations are selling back and forth?
Co-chairs, Representative Clem, the law allows a redaction of vendors, the name of vendors. So by having obtained the name of the vendor, in that case, Clackamas County Shelter, someone could look and see, why is Clackamas County Dog Shelter a vendor to OHSU Primate? What's going on here? Red flag. I mean, I should acknowledge I wasn't around to know exactly how they got that, but that is what my understanding is, redacting the name of the vendor, and they are a vendor. And so if someone made a public request, please list your vendors, and saw an animal shelter, they might start asking questions. What kind of what services are being provided by that vendor?
Yes, sir.
The vendor thing I get, I'm a little more sympathetic there. What about the other part, though, about people who having that individual principal researcher's name somehow helps them create a pattern of something by the federal grant,
sure,
you know, person?
Co-chairs and Representative Clem, sorry I did skip over that. And I guess I really do, before I answer that question, I do want to really encourage you to go look at OHSU's website, because I just continue to be puzzled by with their name up here and the descriptions of the kind of research activity promoting it. The anyone who's intent on criminal activity can actually do that. But and I'm happy to make available a letter from the In Defense of Animals that testified 2 years ago. When a federal grant is filed, and I will hopefully get this accurate, but if I misspeak in any slight way, I apologize. When a researcher files a federal grant to get money, they will provide, obviously, certain kinds of information, including, I believe, how their research, in this case, research animals, will be handled. What is the protocol? What is the treatment? What is all of that? What is the care that they will be provided? If you are wanting to ensure and track how that happens, you get a copy of that research grant, and it says, you know, Andrea is going to handle 50 monkeys. This is the kind of research she's going to do, and this is how she's going to handle the animals. Okay, now let's say you want to know, how is it, you know, Andrea came from another state where it's pretty bad documentation that Andrea abused the research animals there. I want to know what is happening to her 50 monkeys. So you want to know that, and you ask, I'd like Andrea Myers' records on the 50 monkeys. You won't get those because they redact the name. They will not provide you my animal information. There are probably thousands of monkeys up there. You can get all the monkey research material you want about how the animals are treated, but you won't get the one specific to me, so that you can go, wait a minute, Andrea said she would be feeding them 3 times a day. She's feeding them once a day. What's going on there? So it's making that link to how the protocols of how they're going to be handled and actually following up on that. And by removing the name, because I don't know what else the reason is, because their names are all over the place. The kind of research they're doing is all over the place. The federal protocol showing that they handle and are researching monkeys is all over the place. The criminals can make it all up. It's those who want to actually make sure that it's being handled correctly are the ones who would seek this information to be accurate in their education to the community.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I haven't spent any time trying to find people in order to go do either good or bad things, you know, to them. But it seems like if they're opting out of the online deal, that you just, I mean, obviously some people are proud of what they do, trying to save human life by doing research, so they want on there because they're doing things to help with, you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, so they're proud of it, they want on there. Other people, probably proud of what they do, but afraid for their own safety, so they don't want on there. It seems like the concern is, if their name's not on anywhere else except for in the request of a public records law, it's not that hard nowadays to just put a name in Google and then for $5 get their address. So that's, I think, why they don't want their name out there. That's why they don't opt in on that website either, because it's so easy now with just a name to go to people.com or whatever it is and, you know, get everything about somebody. But if you don't have their name, and you only know that the organization's misbehaving maybe, and the organization needs to be held accountable for their grants by their grantor or the media, that OHSU has a rogue employee, that's their need to resolve, not a do-gooder's need to resolve the specific complaint against that person. That should be, OHSU should fire that person. The feds should take away the grant from that organization.
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Clem, a few things. I'm not aware that OHSU removes the actual names of all their... I believe they list all their researchers. I've checked the website. They don't list... They don't have a link to all their photographs. They link all their researchers. By the way, the federal grants are public documents. They will talk about... They have said that. The federal grants, including the individuals' names, are public record, and no one's redacting those names. So there is no way for someone engaged in this activity to not have their name out there. And again, I want to reiterate that I am not here in support of the people who are interested in doing harm, and I hope and believe that the work of law enforcement and everyone else will continue to circumvent, stop, and that behavior. But this is not a law. No one has ever testified that but for this law, you will not know who is engaged in legal research activity up at OHSU with public funds. Their names are all over minutes. They're ready. Actually, they removed their names from some minutes, which was interesting. They're public minutes at one point. But that's not the issue, and there's never, ever been testimony that but for this, no one could find out who it is. I will reiterate, their names are all up on the website, I believe. It's just not all their photographs.
You're getting shaking heads behind you, by the way.
If their names, well, you know, I have never heard them say that their names are not otherwise available. I have never heard them say that the federal grants, they've always talked about getting, you know, the federal grants list all the information, including the names. If they can please provide one researcher whose name does not appear anywhere on their website or a research grant or otherwise is connected with OHSU with the indication that they are working on animal research, I would like to see that name. That has never been the suggestion before. It has always been linking the name to how these particular animals are being treated.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm especially troubled by a couple of these, and Representative Clem brought up one of them, so I'll just bring up the other one. When you're talking about the instance of the self-mutilating monkeys, and your testimony is sort of counter to what Mr. Fisher told me yesterday when he was talking about this bill. You're talking about something that's either a crime or an investigation into abuses. This seems to be a public records request thing, not a investigation. If there's a crime happening, if someone's investigating, this redaction thing doesn't apply. Am I wrong?
Well, co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, the exposure, and I dig in my file, the exposure of that was by Willamette Week in their media request, and they have provided written testimony in the past years how hard it was to get these documents and how difficult it was and the delay and the cost related to it. It was Willamette Week investigative reporting. Unfortunately, we have less and less investigative reporting. That's how it was discovered. I'm happy to find the articles by Willamette Week and get you the letter about the difficulty they had. It was Willamette Week's cover story, I believe, on that brought public attention to it and resulted in a change.
Follow-up. So this law was in effect when Willamette Week?
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, no, this law was not in effect.
And the names of the individuals had everything to do with them being able to discover this? I just have a really hard time thinking that something as insignificant as a name on this thing, when you have all the other records, feeding times and every aspect of each individual subject animal, I just think that your criticism here is not accurate. That if there's an investigation of some kind, that this thing doesn't apply at all.
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan. There are, and I'm happy to follow up and get you more information, and I'm happy to try to clarify. If you asked for the primate record, so you didn't care about the name of the researcher, there are thousands of primate animals. It would cost you a lot of money. But if someone's doing a particular type of research in an area that might give cause or pause to how the animals are being treated, say regarding the abuse of the monkeys, regarding ejaculation, I believe, treatment of the particular monkeys. I think it's needing to know which researcher is doing it and getting those documents. And I don't believe today that if I requested the primate records, handling records, the feeding care records of a particular researcher, that I would get those documents for that researcher. That has not been our understanding. Also, how you spoke about if there's a crime going on.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that OHSU in the past has testified, you know, there's federal government and there's some that happens infrequently, and that can't be the only basis for which we look to see and ensure that there's no criminal activity going on or nothing, and it may not be a crime. I'm not sure what OHSU was doing with the monkeys was a crime. It was unpopular. It was alarming. Some people felt that it was abusive to the animals and inappropriate. I don't think it rose to a crime. That's not the focus. So the problem has been that you, if you're interested in finding out how I'm treating my particular animals and you cannot find that out and connect it to the federal protocols of what I said, how I would treat them. If you can't do that, then how do you ensure that what I'm doing, I say I'm doing? This is public. If they're a private entity, they would have no requirement to do so, but they aren't.
Have a quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up, please.
And maybe this is better for the legal counsel from OHSU to answer this, but so your testimony is an assumption that you couldn't get the records for a particular person whose name was redacted. Is there a mechanism in place that if you followed the breadcrumbs from one monkey that's being researched, that the person caring for that monkey, would you be able to offer all of the documents with a redacted name of all of the monkeys that were in that person's care, or whatever animal?
Sure. I just wanted to say,
ma'am, you can join us.
Yeah. 13,000 pages is hard for any individual to look through, so it's how you get the records to it.
Well, I don't really care what's hard for somebody. It's
well, if you charge so much,
it's free time in the
hands. Mrs. Meyer, can you please remind the committee, this is a list of people, and that this is adding to, right, that they're on this list. And what are some of the other people that are on that? No, you.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
The list of people that you don't have to give your name under Chapter 455. In other words, there's a list of people, but we don't list their addresses, correct?
Co-chairs, yes, I believe DAs and others, addresses. And I will reiterate, so we're clear, ACLU has no, if this law were limited to the home address, the phone number, the home email of these individuals was redacted and not part of the public record, I would not be sitting here today before you opposing it. It's the existence of their name on documents. It is unprecedented. I do not think you will find any other reference in the public records of people who are engaged in any activity on behalf of the public that their name is removed from the existence of the fact that on the records that they create.
Thank you. Other questions, committee members? I think in 1 minute, Mrs. Phillips, did you have a comment to some of the questions you wanted to add?
Can I ask her a question?
For the record, my name is Janet Phillips, co-chair Wisnant and Holby, Representative Sheehan. Your question was, as I recall, if a records request were submitted for all records relating to a particular PI's research, would that request be honored? And the answer to that is yes, but within each of those documents, we would take out the names of everyone.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So we have this question of, is it unprecedented? To what degree is it unprecedented? What do we do? What's our practice with undercover police officers? For instance, what do we, you know, if there's a drug investigation and I do a public records request on a drug investigation. What do I find out and what can't I find out? And I'm just trying to think of what we might analogize this to, if anything, and if we want to give this the most protection that exists in nature, or the second most or the third most, what are the benchmarks?
Co-chair is Representative Smith. I don't have ORS 192, I think 510 and before me, but what I would say is I want to step back a moment and remind that this is not, first of all, this is a public interest balancing test. This is not there's two different kinds of redactions on their exceptions and exemptions to the public record. One is it can be available if the public interest is met, and the other is, you know, it generally it isn't. I would assume in secure information related to a specific officer's undercover, probably using a false name, and I know there's protection in DMV for that false name and all that protection. But this is not that exemption. This is a public interest test, and what we've seen is they apparently have no problem providing it to the media. They do to animal rights organizations. So I don't think you can analogize it to anything, because I believe if an officer were undercover for their safety, I don't care who would be asked in any particular situation if the safety is at issue. But again, I don't have the statute in front of me to be able to point to how that is handled, if at all, at any given time. But I believe the police bureau has available who the officers are. I don't think names of police officers are redacted from the public record, nor any other public employees from documents that have to do with the very core work they do day in and day out that is not a safety issue.
Mr. Chair, follow up,
please.
So with respect, I might analogize to any number of things, whether it's true or not, and I'll make that judgment. And if we want to say this is unprecedented, it never happens, I think we should, I want to test that a little bit. And if the exercise and the odds that you're going to get, you know, five people on this committee to vote no on this, I think are pretty low, right? So maybe the exercise is like put it on the record, you know, we get put an ACLU email, yay or nay or whatever. But if what we're trying to figure out is the best way to discuss and determine public policy, if there's a way to address this, and the reason we have a sunset is so we can evaluate it. The two real questions I have that are really essential aren't just yay or nay on the bill. There, first, how do we evaluate this if it's working and if we're striking the right balance? I could understand why somebody who's doing the research would say, no, I'd rather live in Barbados as far as the world. You know, I want to be in public information Cayman Islands. Okay, I don't want anybody ever to find out. And I can understand why the ACLU would say, well, we generally are on the side of knowing more. And we have sunsets, not just because we want the OHSU lobbyists to come and have to do the same dog and pony to a slightly different committee, you know, blank years from now, but so that we can evaluate and then make either the same determination or a different determination. And so my core questions are, first, how are we going to evaluate? How do we evaluate? How have we evaluated if we are striking the right balance? And second, is there a different balance to strike? And if there is a different balance to strike, the sub-question is, where might that live? And one would be, well, here's how we treat, for instance, you know, blank other thing, right? And if somebody else wants to come up with an analogy, I would be open to that analogy also. But those are, to me, the two questions. So let me ask both of you, how are we evaluating and how should we evaluate if we are striking the right balance between these competing interests?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, and yes, you know your ACLU sometimes comes in and testifies on things, whether we think we will prevail on the vote. 2 years ago, so how do we evaluate it? I think that had been some of the intentions around the two-year sunset. There had been, every session, there had been a report provided to the committee, the log. It was not provided this session, so I'm having a hard time evaluating it. The questions weren't asked on the Senate side. The instructions from 2 years ago as to why it was only a two-year sunset were to sit down and try to work out some compromise or some way to work this out. I had one meeting with the lobbyists for OHSU. That meeting was very preliminary. I was, in fact, the one who provided them, because they didn't have a copy of the document that OHSU had provided in the 2009 hearing. So I gave them that. I said I would be happy to continue meeting to discuss how we might get to a place to resolve this. And that was the last conversation I ever had with them. I was hoping that there might be a way to do this so that we could
strike a different balance and address some of our concerns and some of the concerns of lawful organizations, like In Defense of Animals. I'd ask that they meet with us and with In Defense of Animals, that is a lawful 501c3 organization in the state and elsewhere, and we were not taken up on that. I don't know how you evaluate it this year because we've not seen the law. We've been told that they're no longer treating the media and other people differently, but they also testified that they never treated them differently, and the documents that they provided in the past show that. I agree. The purpose of part of this coming back is to do that, and that has really not happened this session for reasons unbeknownst to me.
Okay, committee.
I'd like, if Mr. Chair, if you're willing, to give her a chance to ask the same question, because I do remember us saying, I was in the chair, and I remember us saying, yeah, let's look at this, see if we can work something out, let's see how we're going to evaluate this. And up to now, I'm unclear of the answer to those two, I think, fundamental questions. One, how are we evaluating for striking the right balance? And two, if there's any other place to, any other balance to strike. And now that I'm sort of having Groundhog Day, oh yeah, I remember sort of the same arguments I heard 2 years ago. And maybe that's because those are the only arguments that exist and the only ones I should care about. But I would at least like to hear the OHSU representative, which I think that's where you're from, answer those questions.
Identify yourself again.
Janet Billups, in-house legal counsel for OHSU, co-chairs Wisnant and Holvey. Representative Smith, let me answer the second question first with respect to, I understand that to sort of be what other options have been evaluated, and it was Phil Donovan and Ryan Fisher, their firm, who've met and spoken with Ms. Myers about that. And Mr. Fisher.
And Lou Frederick also.
With respect to the first question, and forgive me if I do sound like I am saying the same thing, but having looked at the options and our history, what we have seen in terms of evaluating the efficacy is that we have a much lesser degree of violence against researchers in our state.
And by what?
At OHSU. Excuse me?
Measured by what?
Compared to California.
Okay.
In terms of
they're crazy.
Incidents. We also have a zero incidence of threats of violence, acts of intimidation towards our employees who are not at the PI level, the principal investigator level. So it's working in terms of we don't have, it's working in the negative. We don't have more horror stories to report, and so the best answer that I have for you is we have this in place, and we don't have negative outcomes, so the outcome is a positive outcome.
Mr. Chair, I won't press the matter, but let me say, in striking the balance, that's not a fully helpful, fully robust set of evaluations. So what I would, I know that we got to get out of here, and I don't want you to any more time. It is to me merely saying, well, it seems to us that attacks have been reduced. That's a really strong interest, one I'm more sensitive to than most of the other competing interests. And I would, like, in evaluating this and how we're evaluating it, saying, well, this is what's happening in California, maybe is the best we can do. But I still wonder if there's a slightly different thing we can do to get just about the exact same benefit to the employees at OHSU, while also balancing, you know, other competing interests and figuring out that, how we're evaluating that. And frankly, having my good friends for your advocacy firm, who I've worked on with bills and like very much, having them do the balance is not sufficient to me.
And if I could leave, co-chairs Wisnant and Holvey, Representative Smith, if I could leave you with one other piece of information. The other side of the balance is every scrap of paper is provided to requesters. So the balance is, as near as we can tell, this is working, and every request is honored except we take out the names. All information relating to the care of animals and the conduct of animal research is publicly available to anyone who asks for it. And to us, that strikes the right balance.
Thanks. Sorry if I was hard on you both. You're both wonderful people.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here and all those who testified. I guess for me, I don't want to oversimplify it, but in my mind I kind of have. It's a sunset that's already been awarded in the past. We're hearing the same arguments that received the award in the past, so I can appreciate the argument again for the extension of sunset. I don't have a problem for that. I think if we're looking for a spirited debate and we can change this up a little bit, we might consider an amendment for like a buffer zone for the potential funerals of the primate. We might want to consider it, Representative Smith, and maybe you and I can talk offline about it, but I appreciate your desire.
There's an interstate compact on this that we're going to refer to.
Thank you both for being here today. Thank you.
I may need a buffer zone.
Okay, with that conversation, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 392. Committee members, good job. Thank you. And we'll adjourn the House Committee General Government Consumer Protection. Have a good day.